This is React Podcast. I'm Chantastic. In this episode of React Podcast, Sean Swix Wang opens up about his new book, The Coding Career Handbook, Guides, Principles, Strategies, and Tactics from Code Newbie to Senior Dev. His book shines a spotlight on career patterns and practices that many of us had to learn the hard way. You know, uphill in the snow both ways. We talk about a few of my favorite lessons in this book, but there are so many that I recommend you just get it. So if you have an appetite for more, get your copy of the Coding Career Handbook at learninginpublic.org. This episode is sponsored by AWS Amplify and Infinite Red. AWS Amplify is the fastest, easiest way to develop web and mobile apps that scale. I bet that you're already using at least one AWS service to support customers today. So you're already familiar with the limitless offerings of composable services available on AWS. But sometimes all that capability can be overwhelming. You just want one thing that's intentionally designed to make modern full-stack development easy. AWS Amplify is for you. AWS Amplify takes the power and scale of AWS and tailors it to your needs as a cloud-based web and mobile app developer. Use it to spin up hosting, storage, authentication, managed GraphQL or REST APIs, serverless functions, and so much more. You can start using AWS Amplify for free with their generous free tier. It's great for you tinkerers, entrepreneurs, and bootstrappers. As you scale, you only pay for additional services you use. It's pretty great. Visit awsamplify.info/react to find a quick tutorial for React developers like us. That's awsamplify.info/react. Infinite Red is your go-to resource as a React and React Native developer. They know React and React Native inside and out. Whether your company is Fortune 500 or fighting fortune for an open co-working desk, Infinite Red can help you design, build, and ship quality apps. They've been doing it for over 10 years, and listeners of this show absolutely love having them as a friendly expert resource. Infinite Red will give you $750 when you start or refer a new project. Get expert React and React Native help at reactpodcast.infinite.red. Swix, welcome back to React Podcast.
Woo! Thank you. Thanks for having me back. I think we do this once a year, maybe.
Is that? Yeah, I think it was like right before, was it ReactConf in 2019?
And then my first time was on 2018.
Yeah. Was that also at ReactConf?
That was React Rally, which is kind of like community ReactConf.
Okay.
At the time, we weren't sure if ReactConf was even going to be held, because
yeah.
I think apparently it went dead for a bit.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's alive and well.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious if they're going to do anything online this year, or if they're just going to kind of take the pass and, you know, do it next year. Get another 3 year out of not having an official concurrent mode.
I think the time is over. Though, you know, one fun thing I do for the React, you know, the subreddit is that I track anniversaries. And
okay.
Next week is the third birthday of React 16. So 26th of September.
Oh, wow.
That's when React 16 came out 3 years ago. And it used to be like this library, you know, you could take it as a good thing and a bad thing. Like React is not kind of, it's kind of, you know, not progressed that much, at least not changed that much, at least since hooks. But then also it's like a more of a marker stability. But then they went out and put React 17, I think just to spite me. So I can't say that anymore.
Well, you know, it's not out yet. So you might, yet.
I know. I suspect they're actually going to drop it on the third birthday just to go like, yeah, like it's not take this too long. It's pretty funny because like Sebastian has gone on the record saying that they need to, you know, break things faster. So
yeah.
But I think, you know, this last stretch for concurrent mode has been a pretty challenging one. So
yeah.
I don't blame them. You know,
yeah.
They got better things to do than bump version numbers. So
yeah. But I mean, I tend to agree with that, and I think that a lot of people, you know, who maybe are invested in React and, you know, aren't just popping up to complain about how hard it is to like keep up with like new features, would prefer some of these like big headline features be tied to, you know, like major versions of React. So it's kind of a, I do hope that they start to break things more and like, you know, actually get closer to like the vision that I know they all want, which is something that is kind of a little bit more like through and through connected to their vision instead of supporting all of these legacy concepts.
Yeah. I encourage anyone who's interested in like front end in general to check into the CSS4 debate. It's pretty interesting because it's a completely sort of artificial version number that they're going to throw on top of CSS just as a marketing tactic. But version numbers matter in terms of like communicating forward progress. And I think that that's what they're trying to go for.
Interesting. Where would, if anyone was interesting, where would they check out the debate just, around CSS4?
Just CSS Tricks. I think they have a CSS4 article. And it kind of summarizes the state of the debate.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's super fascinating. I mean, there is something important, you know, and I think we forget about this kind of from an engineering standpoint. We think about numbers very literally, right? Like, is this, you know, is this just a patch? Is it, you know, a minor? Are we adding a feature? Or is it like a major? And like, we forget that, you know, humans love flags, right? We love to have something that we can rally under and be like, I'm on, you know, version X of this thing. And everybody knows that version X is the encapsulation of like, you know, these five flagship features. And, you know, there's something very human about kind of like acknowledging like, hey, maybe there isn't technically a breaking change, but there's a breaking like mental model, or like we're investing in like a different way of thinking about this thing. And the best practices have changed. And that's enough to say this is a new thing.
Yeah, I think Dan Abramov from you know is pretty animated whenever he talks about Semver as a social contract. So I basically just parrot him every time this topic comes up.
And what is that?
It's a social contract because you know, Semver people get really upset when you like break stuff and then it's you call it a minor when they think it should be a major or whatever.
Yeah.
But it really like Semver is as specific as what is this piece of software supposed to do. And given enough users and enough scale, all software is underspecified. Therefore, we don't really know what it's supposed to do. Therefore, Semver is just a communication between maintainers and users.
Yeah. It's not a legal contract. So you've been busy at work, and I'm just gonna make a hard switch. We could talk about React all day, but that's not why we're here. And I'm really excited about the work that you've been doing because it actually transcends some of the reasons that we usually get together, which is to talk about like technical stuff. And you're talking about how people actually make a career in around coding and all of the things that they would need to know, all of the avenues in which they could take to get there, what it looks like in like different styles of work and different technologies and how to, you know, choose stuff. So I want to ask you, like, just, you know, for anyone who's not familiar with it already, tell me a little bit about, you know, the Coding Career Handbook and like what it has meant to you over the last, you know, year specifically, but maybe even, you know, 3 years before that.
Yeah. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about it, because it's really hard to, it's really awkward to pitch my own career advice. So it's better to have it to someone to talk it through with. And it's also really weird to talk about it, given that, you know, everyone knows that I haven't been in the software industry that long. But, you know, I've objectively done well. But like there's still a lot of stuff that I don't know. So it's like a very weird thing to write. And I think the main reason I wrote it was the Learn in Public essay that everyone knows me for is just like objectively the most sort of impactful piece of writing I've ever done.
Yeah.
And so when I sort of thought about like what else do I have to say about this idea, and I think there's a lot that goes beyond just Learn in Public. And I think that actually is the more interesting stuff that I always want to talk about, because especially like, you know, the more you sort of get familiar with programming, with frameworks, with libraries, with languages, you realize that they're just, you know, what probably matters on a longer term basis is sort of meta skills, like the skills around the coding. And I think I got this phrase from Charity Majors. She says like the coding is always the easiest part of the coding career.
Mm.
And Charity Majors is the CTO of Honeycomb, used to work at Facebook, and I think was an early employee at Parse. Anyway, so yeah, like, and then I think another founding ingredient for like why I was like, okay, this is a project that I should work on, was I did a survey of every public engineering career ladder. So like, time to time, some companies are actually publish what they use to evaluate their own engineers and promote. And so I have a list of like 30-ish engineering career ladders. Actually, not that many, right? Like there should be more. But anyway, so like, I mean, this is not like confidential. We should normalize making it public. Anyway, so I studied all of them, and I realized that, like, you know, the way that people evaluate their software engineers, especially the more senior you get, about 1 in 4 of the criteria are actually technical in terms of like your technical competency and leadership. Everything else is about like working well with teammates, having business impact, understanding the bigger picture. Like, quite frankly, like 75% of what you're evaluated on as a software engineer is nothing to do with code. And it's, you have to have technical knowledge, but then you have to apply it to your organization, your team, and maybe, you know, at the more senior level, your industry. And I think that's an interesting insight that, like, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we are code enabled humans, and then and we try to apply that to other stuff. So it's like that realization, and then there's the question of like, why now? You know what I mean? Like, and I think it was an observation that because I had 2 months off between leaving Netlify and joining AWS, where I am right now. This is the only time that I will ever write a book like this. And I think mostly it's focused at this idea of like, let's target this junior to senior transition and try to really nail everything that people should have this understanding of as they transition from junior to senior. And I think most people, like, the reason that there aren't that many books that exist in this process is that people don't really stop to write books about it. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of books about like technical interviews and like cracking the coding interview and all that, and then you get the interview and then you're like, you know, you're starting off and then there's a void, and then and then you get really really senior architects writing about like, I don't know, like clean code and whatever, but like, you know, like there's no sort of in the middle books to help you make that transition. And I thought that's really strange. So I thought I'd just give it a go, you know, and this is the first version of it. I just put it out this year. My intention is to just refine it every year. You know, I know it's not as good as it could be, but with the help of, you know, the now over 1,000 readers that I have, try to make it better every year. And you know, maybe it's not the best book for junior seniors this year, but in 10 years it could be, you know? So I think it's, I'm trying to live that whole philosophy that I'm describing, which is kind of, you'll never be, you know, perfect on day one, but like you just make a small step and then you sort of, keep pushing the boundaries as you go along.
Yeah. Well, I mean, something that has always struck me about this, like, notion of learning public, cause it is, just speaking personally, antithetical to the way that I live. Like, I am one of those people who just wants to like get it all polished, get it all nice, and then like just kind of like, you know, have this thing wrapped up in a bow and like put it out there. But I think that is, I mean, just maybe like an old way of thinking about things, because I think that the way that you think about stuff is so well suited for right now. Where people want to, you know, you've mentioned that you feel a little bit like maybe nervous, I guess, about being the person who's writing this book, you know, about the junior to senior transition, because you haven't, you know, it hasn't been, you know, this isn't a story that happened like 15 or 20 years ago, right? Like it happened relatively recently. But, you know, embodying that philosophy, like people actually get to see that like this is real. Right, like this isn't something that you've kind of rewritten in your head to like sound better than it is over the past like 10 years. Like it's fresh because like they actually saw it happen. Like, you know, they saw what, you know, things looked like a year ago, or, you know, like a, you know, 6 months before that. And seeing that progression, like people seem to be invested into, you know, they have like a piece in your success and know that it could also work for them as well. Have you seen that in the people who have enjoyed your book, that they've actually enjoyed seeing like the progression of you over these years?
Definitely. You know, they're sort of staff and principal and CTO level people who have bought the book and told me that they enjoyed it regardless. And it's pretty, you know, I guess rewarding to hear from them. But I also kind of don't care about external validation. You know, sure, what I mean? Like, if this is true, then it's true. Like, who, yeah, why does it matter who says it? Do you know what I mean? Like, so there's a, you know, I think we want to have this comfort of like, there's some credibility behind what the person's saying, mm-hmm, but ultimately it actually doesn't matter. Like, it just matters if it's right or not, and if it's useful to you. So it's good to have some, but I'm sure like I also have people who don't think I'm qualified to write a book. So, sure, that's fine. Like, yeah, they're entitled to their opinion, but I'm entitled to also publish and try my best to articulate what I think is true. I think everyone should. Like, I think if you don't agree with a single word, you should still write your own set of principles. You know what I mean? Like, that's just regardless of what seniority level you are. Yeah. So I think that's true. I also want to push back on that idea of like how not learning in public is maybe old or something. Like, I think there are different levels of learning in public. And so, I always make the point to say that learning public is not for everyone. and there's different degrees of learning in public. And even me as sort of like principal advocate of this thing, I don't think you should live the majority of your life in public. Like, so like, I'm just saying go from 0% public to like 1 to 5 to 10%. And even that is like a big lift for people. But like,
yeah,
I'm trying to wake people up to the idea that your default has been zero and it, yeah, doesn't serve you well. It does not serve you well.
That's it. That's interesting. And I can definitely latch onto that because, I mean, just even recently, we've been trying to like do something a little bit different where we like put, you know, live stream some of these conversations to YouTube. We're doing that right now. And that has been like me kind of turning the dial up from like totally private. I have control over like exactly how like I am perceived. You know, if I stutter over a question or whatever, like, it's under my control. I can cut it out, try again. No big deal. Nobody knows any better. But that is kind of in a way just turning the dial up from like, you know, 0 to 1. It's like, okay, well, it was all private before. We're just going to expose a little bit of this and see, you know, see how it goes.
Honestly, if you speak at all, I think you're already like way more public than most.
Sure, sure.
And I also think that at some level of audience reach, like with, you know, with great audience comes great responsibility. You do owe it to your audience to sort of moderate how much you put out there that's totally raw and unverified and unchecked.
Yeah.
So you do need some polish at some scale, but it's probably a lot bigger than people think. People sure think that, like, you know, 20,000 Twitter followers is big. It's not. It's nothing.
Yeah. Well, especially since they're only seeing a subset of your tweets anyway, like on any given day.
Correct. Yeah. So like, you know, like you should always like be like kind of like on the edge of what you're comfortable with, mm-hmm, and just kind of pushing that. But definitely I'm not saying, you know, publish everything sort of half done, super low quality. I definitely don't want to be the cheerleader of that either. I do encourage polish. I just also think that, the default mode of like, I'm trying to correct for the default, and the default is private. That's all. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
of course, try to polish things if you can.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And I think that's a really good distinction, right? Like, it's not that you are trying to put misinformation out or like bad quality work. It's just that like, when you learn something, don't be afraid to share it. The place that you're in, you don't have to be an expert before you start sharing things. Now, I'm kind of curious, you've mentioned that people, you know, have responded like, you know, what right do you have to write a book? And that seems kind of odd to me because, you know, effectively you're writing a manuscript and like distributing it for people who want to, you know, want to buy it. What is it that you think that people, I guess, have in their mind that makes this like some type of sacred ground that is only available to, you know, elites?
It's a fixed mindset. So essentially in their minds, there can only be like, I don't know, 5 books in the world about computer coding careers, and they should be written by Linus Torvalds, like, you know, Jeff Dean, like, you know, people who've had like 6 decades of making it in life. The funny thing is these guys are not interested in writing career advice books. You know what I mean? Like, so I think one thing is the fix versus growth mindset, like not having, you know, saying like, I only want to, I think what they're telling what I hear, so, you know, when I launched on Hacker News, and I got to page one, and it did well for what it was, which is,
sure,
you know, a pretty expensive book. What I hear when people comment these things is that they're just not my target audience, and so I don't pay them any mind. I think that people who are creators, like you are a creator, so every podcaster that I explain this to doesn't really get it, because you're sympathetic to the idea of what it's like to create. But sure, these people who don't create lurk in the comments, and then they tell you that they're not your target audience, so I just don't pay them any mind. Their opinions are good for them, but they don't have to affect me.
Yeah. Well, I ask because I know that this is probably one of the biggest reasons that people hate learning in public, is because, especially for the type of work that, you know, is represented by, you know, coding, when you learn in public, you open yourself up to criticism from this whole class of kind of like classic programmers, maybe, who are really just kind of like constantly like judging your, what is it, credibility or like ability to be like sharing something. And so it feels like you're kind of like living this thing that you're actually recommending to people. What are some like tactics that you employ for not taking it too personally and continuing to create and publish anyway?
It bothers me, right? Like I read it, it does get me down, does get my feelings. So something I actually have a chapter on, I have a section on my book called Dealing with Haters. And this one actually comes from Paul Graham, who founded Hacker News. So he knows a thing or two about dealing with, you know, disagreeable comments. And you just remember that there's this hierarchy of how people engage with arguments, right?
Yeah.
At the basis level, there's sort of name calling and ad hominem, like I'll attack your character instead of attacking your point. And then there's sort of trying to sort of responding to tone, like I don't like the tone of your thing, instead of like, I don't, you know, you're the fundamental point that you're making is wrong. And then it goes all the way up to refuting the central point. So like, what level of disagreement are people engaging with you with? So if they're just attacking your character, your backgrounds, and not really disagreeing with your point, then, you know, that's the level that they're choosing to engage with. And you don't have to respond to anything on that level. You can just choose to be better.
It's an interesting tactic. So you can look at that chart, and we'll find a link to that chart. But you can look at the chart at triangle and basically decide at which point you want to engage with people and just disregard the rest.
Yeah, just have a filter, right? Not everyone's opinion is equal.
Yeah. Now I want to go back to something that you'd mentioned, and this ties into like the necessity for a book like this that talks about that junior to senior transition, is that most of what differentiates a junior from a senior is not like raw coding talent. And I want to press into that because I think that might be one of the most important things that we cover today, is like, what are those things? Like if it's not coding talent, I mean, obviously there's a certain level of cost of entry, right? Like you have to be good enough at coding to be able to progress. But it sounds like you're saying like there is a point where you're good enough, and then it's these extra qualities that actually take you up the ladder.
Yep. So the point at which you're good enough is essentially, can you be assigned tasks and independently execute without supervision? That's the bar that a lot of people stop at for what is a senior engineer. And it's a pretty good bar. It means that, like, you know, I can sure, the buck stops with you. I can hand you a Jira ticket, a project, whatever, and trust that you'll take it from beginning to end. And if there's something that's a deal breaker and a blocker, you will throw the exception instead of suppressing the exception. So I think that's a pretty good contract to have with your senior engineers. But then there's also like a lot of non-technical bars, and that's kind of what I discuss in like the junior and the senior section. So it's, for example, one of the other discussions of senior engineers is that they sort of, they're multipliers for the rest of their team, right? So they help to train other engineers. They help to work on infrastructure that I guess enforces code standards, or
sure,
builds the architecture that sort of prevents a lot of technical debt in future. Mm-hmm. They know how to migrate between legacy and systems and new tech, new solutions that they're trying to adopt. Those are all, you know, very, very desirable qualities of a senior engineer as well. In the book, like I actually kind of break it down to four broad topics. So like it's kind of like code. There's code level stuff. There's learning, how seniors learn versus how juniors learn, how juniors behave, so behavior, and then the last part is how they impact their team, so co-learning behavior and team. And I have, you know, any number of comments on each of those sections, but I just wanted to keep it high level.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, something that I find interesting that you mentioned, and I think I have been just processing this a lot over the last couple of years, is something you specifically mentioned about the ability to migrate from legacy tech to new tech. And I think that we see this a lot. There are a lot of tools out there now that kind of automate like code standards, right? And, you know, with the goal, I guess, of kind of communication and participation and like making things better. But a lot of times they kind of like create arguments or like artificially restrict what you're able to do. And it sounds to me like something that you learn along the way in this transition is kind of the nuances of those things. Like when it could be a good time to like implement something like this, the nuance of like, you know, well, hey, we're really excited about technology X, but how do we get there? Not just like, hey, why don't we rewrite everything, you know, because like there's a respect for like how hard it is to have done the thing in the first place. Could you talk to me about a little bit more about like kind of that migration mindset and kind of sustainability and how that plays into the senior role?
I think I'm not sure who wrote this, so I'm gonna kick myself once I remember, but essentially, like, you know, as engineers, we're like, we kind of like so someone made the analogy of engineers to architects. Like, we like to bulldoze everything from scratch and then just build from, build from scratch, you know? And it's pretty apt. Like, whenever we see technical debt, like, we hate it. Like, you know, it's like, oh, this is, you know, this is using, I don't know, like, React mix-ins, and those aren't cool anymore.
Yeah.
Render props, those aren't cool anymore.
Sure.
So let's just like, you know, take a cycle and just like refactor this whole thing. And it really takes some level of maturity.
I mean, I'm in apps that are using HAML, so
it really takes some level of maturity to say like, no, like, yes, like this is a pain and we have to kind of, you know, deal with it, but like that's not so important right now. This is and it takes some judgment to make that call, but then also sometimes to make the opposite call and go like, yes, like, okay, it's gone to a point where this is actively slowing us down. Mm-hmm. And if we slow down, we can speed up later. So that is a conversation that needs to happen. And it also means, because as a senior engineer, you're not actually the only stakeholder in this. Like, you have to be able to sell this to product people, to your CEO, to marketing people, who don't care about your tech stack, who don't care about your code base. So it's a lot about persuasion as well. Once you've got the internal buy-in among your engineering team, and that's hard enough because a lot of engineers love to bike shit. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a like, sort of very high level view of like,
sure,
you know, what that looks like. And then I also talk about like some sort of migration strategies. I really like, you know, something that they do at Uber and Facebook, which is just extensive use of feature flags instead of long-lived branches. I like that idea as well. And it seems like the industry is kind of slowly moving that
sure.
in that direction. So in other words, like feature flags as a way to sort of test in production to. Migrate everything in a single code base and then eventually delete without much disruptive change. But it works until the point where feature flags become technical debt themselves instead of
sure.
methods, instead of a means to clear technical debt. So Uber actually wrote a tool to automatically scan through, like, I think they had like 7,000 feature flags, and then they scanned their code base, and then they were like, okay, 2,000 of these are actually not in use anymore. We should delete them. So solutions can work at a certain scale, and then once you get past an order or two of magnitude, then they will stop working because they just weren't designed for that solution. So then you need to know that you need to change solutions at that point in time.
Yeah, I like how you touch on the importance of persuasion, you know, which is basically internal sales and marketing, and how critical that is to... How critical that is to like demonstrating ownership over something, like actually taking ownership of the thing and demonstrating that you can take it from, you know, this point to the next point, whether that be a full like ground up rewrite or some like long lived migration strategy. How do you see people demonstrating persuasion in these four groups that you've talked about, like, you know, like code, learning, behavior, and team?
That's a tricky one. I mean, I think this is more, I mean, I was just thinking more about migrations and technical debt in general. Whereas this sort of four aspects, it was just more, these are where I notice the biggest differences between junior and senior are, and in my attempts to really condense and summarize multidimensional thing into four, those are what I landed on. So I don't really have a strong view on that, on the on how persuasion applies to each of these things. I don't. That's something I have to think about for sure. I think.
Okay, cool.
I'm just going to take a pass on that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's kind of a weird question. I think it's something that I'm maybe independently interested in, but I do want to kind of tie in some of these ideas. Behavior, like that's a big thing, and I think we did kind of touch on that in kind of the way you think, the way that you decide to roll out a decision, how easy you think it is to maybe theoretically roll out some type of thing. Mm. How do you think about behavior as representing you and being able to take, like, be a vehicle for taking your career kind of like up the ladder?
Well, you know, people remember what you do, you know, and talk is cheap, but it's definitely more about what you do than anything else. I kind of don't view it as like doing anything in order to be perceived as doing the thing is very performative.
okay.
You should just do it because it's the right thing for you at that point in time.
Sure.
So that's kind of how I approach this thing. You know, it's very much like, honestly, like, you know, instead of trying to look good, just do the right things and hopefully it will end up looking good more often than it doesn't look good. And I think that's much better than trying to skip to the end result of just looking good and in the end result. So that's why I try to talk about things like, the other thing I also like to push back on is a lot of people, when they're asked what's the difference between a junior and a senior engineer, they always sort of cast the junior engineer as like the bad engineer and then senior as the good engineer.
Mm.
And I try to push back on that because I think, you know, probably the only sort of definitive difference between junior and senior is the pay scale, and the rest, like, you could be, you know, on everything else you can have multiple dimensions and you can be more junior in some things and more senior in other things.
Mm.
So I definitely sort of want to push back on like this artificial divide that I've hooked onto essentially for marketing purposes,
sure,
to not actually internalize it too much, because that creates this artificial mentality of like, either A, I'm a junior, therefore I suck at everything, or B, I'm a senior now, I have nothing to learn from juniors. And that could not be further from the truth. So, I mean, you know, I think one of the things that I really like to talk about as well is, you know, I'll pick up one of the behaviors, right?
Yeah.
When evaluating technologies, juniors will typically like look at the developer experience based on like the getting started. Like, look at this awesome talk. Look at this getting started. Look at this hello world. Look at all the other people who use it. That's great. Whereas the senior engineers might look for they've seen a lot of these and they've seen a lot of it not work out. So they'll look for hidden costs in terms of user experience and in terms of abstraction leaks. Like, all abstractions are leaky. Like, where does this hurt me? Like, a lot of times their first question will be like, okay, like, this all sounds great, but what's the catch, right? And if you don't get a very convincing answer as the catch, they know that you're trying to bullshit them. Like, whereas, you know, it's very, very rare that you have a complete free lunch, right, in tech. Like, it happens, but it's super rare. But you also start to care about user experience more than just developer experience, right? Like, as a beginner, I know that, you know, the first thing for me was to get up and running the fastest with a React app. Whereas a senior engineer will be like, okay, well, hold on, like, my bundle's like, you know, 2 megabytes right now. Like, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
You know, like, so we get that, especially like we just had the other day, we just had one of these discussions in the React Reddit. And I think it's healthy for both these things to exist, because when you're trying to get going, you're just trying to get going. You should not have that many concerns handed to you at that point in time. But yeah, that's one example of how I think behaviors change as you sort of grow in capacity, as you start to have a little bit more personal experience.
Interesting. Sorry, I totally didn't understand that framing of it until you described it to me. So I probably shouldn't have started asking questions until
no, that's cool.
I knew a little bit about the framing a little bit better. I do like I do think that that's really interesting. And I'm curious, you had mentioned that in a lot of cases, you know, these the differences between a junior and a senior are multidimensional, and it's really hard to say, like, they're, you know, apart from trying to help people develop their skills in these dimensions, to say, like, oh, these are the strict characteristics of someone who's starting and the strict characteristics of someone who's further along. I'm curious, in an ideal world, how would you see it, like, described, or how would we, like, live in a way where we're able to, like, draw from the benefits of someone who is new to the career, but then also, like, draw from the benefits of someone who has had that experience? What do those communications look like, I guess, in an ideal world?
Yeah. First of all, I think as an industry, we need to have a lot more apprenticeships. It's ridiculous that we have this, like, big gap between, like, okay, you are, you know, you just graduated from boot camp or college, and we're immediately hire you as a full-time engineer. A lot of people can do that, but a lot of people cannot, and they spend a lot of time sort of trying to find their way, but then also getting to jobs that may not be that good for them. And I think having an intermediate path of like normalizing apprenticeships in tech would be a good idea to sort of build that bridge.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the other thing that I also think about when you ask about this this stuff is sort of like this stupid question, safe harbor, which I know, you know, in our prep that you like to talk about, which is essentially like, I borrowed this concept from acting, where if you know that you have a known flaw, you just call it out and say that, like, I know I'm about to say something stupid, but and then you just say your stupid thing. Most likely, you know, you're not the only one thinking that, or you're not the only one with that same question. But, like, you also communicate that, like, yes, like, I understand on some level this is, like, you know, this is kind of like a confession of weakness. But being able to embrace that weakness, like, sort of kind of owns that. But it also lets like puts the ball in the other person's court. So, like, if you're a more junior person saying this to a more senior person, now the senior person is challenged to explain this to you. And if they can't do it, it's their fault, not yours. Because the senior developers, you know, should be able to explain complex things in simple fashion. Otherwise, they don't understand what they're talking about. A lot of people cannot. So I think that stupid question, safe harbor, you know, is this idea that, like, you can invoke it, just say, like, you know, just lampshade it. And that's one of the tactics that I talk about in the book as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can say, like, from, you know, one of my favorite pieces of advice that you gave on this show, I think the first time you were on, we talked about that a little bit before we hit record, was that, like, you're going to say it better than me, like, being able to sacrifice your ego for learning. Like, what's your quote on that?
Yeah, you can learn so much on the internet for the low, low price of your ego.
Yeah, and I think that it goes both ways, right? You know, if you're the you know, junior talking to a senior, and if you're feeling insecure, leading with that insecurity and being like, you know what, let's back up a second. I don't actually know what we're talking about. And, like, would it be weird to think about it like this? And, like, starting the dialogue from that angle. But then also, you know, from that senior side of saying, like, hey, I actually am not totally sure that I know all the places that we're using this thing, and, like, you know, how it's being used, and, like, the places that we need to extend it and whatnot. And so, instead of just telling you how to do something, I'd love to learn from you on, like, how this thing is being used.
Yeah. That's totally valid as well. I think being able to essentially enable all forms of communication. Not just, like, junior to senior, but just, like, programmers do a lot of things to avoid talking to other humans. I think if we like talked more, we would be able to facilitate knowledge transfer, but then also be on the same page before we start committing code, because that will save a lot of, you know, more code in the future, undoing it, the misunderstandings that we have. And it's hard, especially as we go remote. There's a lot less opportunities for communication and agreement, especially in body language, but then also in just opportunities to hash out stuff. So we should, I try to encourage this as well, like, do more writing, just in general, like, when in doubt, just write stuff down, send it to people, it scales yourself. It also notes down your questions for future you, you know, but also, you know, future other readers as well. And I think, you know, something I appreciate at Amazon is that there is a very strong emphasis on writing, to the point that we ban PowerPoint in internal meetings, right? write the memo, try to explain and give narrative context to everything. And I think that's important.
Yeah. One thing that I really love about your writing in general, but then also in this book, is that it's a tremendous resource to other resources. And there's a lot of quotes, there's a lot of references, a lot of, you know, there's a huge bibliography of resources that you have gained wisdom from and kind of consolidated into this book. And I want to talk about like that process, like being someone who has, you know, learned publicly, how important is it to like, I guess, like piggyback off of the work that other people are doing, or I guess more importantly, spotlight it as you're learning from them.
Yeah. Part of it is attribution. Like, this wasn't my idea. I should quote the original source because, you know, thank you for coming up with it. But then also part of it is a strategy for dealing with my own imposter syndrome, because you don't have to believe me. You can believe this other super experienced person. And then I can sort of step back and be like, I'm the curator. You know, I kind of put everything in context and give you some nice intro to link ideas together. So that you know, even there is like a value add that I think that people really appreciate. It's probably consistently shouted out as one of the biggest surprises about the book, because I don't talk about it in the landing page. So I should probably do that. I'm terrible. This is my first time selling something like this. But anyway, I think the other thing is also understanding that there's a rich history to a lot of these ideas. It's not just one person talking. It's definitely a crowd of very experienced people who all have, you know, converge on the similar ideas. And they're like, to me, that means that they're not likely to change. And I really love investing in things that don't change. It's much better than people, you know, people always like want to know like what's going to be different in 5 to 10 years. And like the Jeff Bezos line, is like, I'd much rather invest in things that don't change, because then I can just throw, like, there's no possibility of overinvesting. Like you'll just be early instead of wrong. And I think that's an interesting insight as well. In terms of like the in the battlefield of ideas, these are the things that have seemed to have stood the test of time, which I kind of have picked up the term Lindy effect, which is the expectation that things that have lasted for a while will tend to last a bit longer, just as a statistical estimator of their longevity. So those are things that I really like to think about, and I really like how you linked it to pick up what they put down, because I didn't really think about it in that way of in terms of borrowing credibility. But it is, you know, when you're getting started as a blogger, one of the most high leverage things you can do is that you can summarize the key books in your chosen field. Every book, every industry has like their Bible, you know, their equivalent of like the books that everyone should read, but doesn't, you know, they don't, just in general, right. People don't read it through. So what you can do as a beginning blogger is to read the whole thing through. You not only have a much better retention of what, you know, that source content material is, you also get to build your audience. Nobody has to care about who you are. They just have to care. They know that the book is already important and good. You're just helping them get there. And as a voice, you know, if you do a good job of it, then you get to start to build your own name as someone with taste and someone with the ability to make things relevant for people. Yeah. So, but then the pick up what you put down idea, you know, which is one of the principles, and it's probably one of the most highly referenced principles after Learn in Public, is this idea that you should actively engage with the mentors, right? Like, a lot of people, you know, I think they say that, you know, I'm looking for mentors, or like they set up these platforms where you can apply for mentor and mentee matching. It's a job that like is very ill-defined, and of course it's unpaid, but it's just ill-defined. That's the real problem with it. Like there's no contract where like, is the mentor supposed to come up with some sage life advice that you could go apply and, you know, that will just fix your whole career? Like, no, like we all know a little bit of things, and we all have some measure of self-interest. Yes, I want my mentees to succeed. But I'm also not responsible for all that they do and all that they're interested in. So I think it's better to just engage with individual mentors on a one-by-one, project-by-project basis. And if it ends up that you keep working with them, then you kind of work your way into being a mentee relationship, rather than like, hey, will you sign this like, you know, unenforceable contract on day one, and then we'll agree to work together. I don't think that's the way that two, you know, sort of sovereign individuals kind of should work together. But I think it's just And then I think I want to sort of close it by talking about this idea, like, what is the number one reason that people stop blogging, they stop learning in public, is because they don't receive feedback. Like, you should not care about feedback in theory, but we're all humans. I care about feedback.
Yeah.
And when are you guaranteed feedback is when you respond to something that someone else already did. Like, that's when, you know, as a whole, people don't respond in general. Like, this is called the 99% rule. You know, most people just lurk and consume passively. If you engage with anyone at all, you're likely to get a response because that's the contract for what people put out. And people recognize when you come back repeatedly as someone with quality. So, like, you know, if someone puts out a blog post or you kind of go through it and give comments, if someone puts out a new library, you actually try it out and you report bugs, you know, so on and so forth, right? And I think the more you sort of engage, the more you become a collaborator, you become a friend, and you become a peer eventually. And I think this is a very, very consistent and fast method of leveling up.
Yeah, I want to dive into the practicals of that, because I think that can't be overstated for people who want to level up and kind of learn from people, but can't actually get time with them, you know, actually say, like, hey, you know, if you hit some up and be like, hey, I just want an hour of your time for you to mentor me, like, it's never going to happen, right?
It's too generic.
Yeah, but
Tim Ferriss actually has this saying, which I really like, which is the world punishes the general wish and rewards the specific ask. So if you're just like, make my life better, make me a better developer, no one has any idea. But if you have a specific thing that you want to work on and get better at, people, I will have a lot of suggestions for you. You know what I mean? So don't ask me to do that work for you of defining what you want to get better at. Figure it out for yourself and then engage with the experts.
It's interesting. So in a practical way, what would this look like? Would this look like commenting on, you know, other people's content that they've put out there, kind of giving feedback on stuff that's like on Hacker News or, you know, Product Hunt, like you mentioned, giving feedback on, you know, PRs, investing in open source, taking on a feature.
Yeah, yeah, keep going, right? Like, there's a so Li Hao, which is one of the community members, he literally became a Svelte maintainer by going through the code base of Svelte and seeing that there are a lot of to-dos, and he followed up on the to-dos and sent in PRs, and then they made him a maintainer. But read through source code, actually try out stuff that people launch. There's bound to be bugs. There's bound to be, you know, stuff that you don't really get. You have the benefit of saying, like, I'm a beginner, so I give you the beginner's sort of perspective on this. And of course they want to improve it and make it more accessible to people who are not experts, because these people are experts and that's the one thing that they don't have, which is the beginner's mind. I think probably the easiest one that most people can do is sort of summarize, you know, like restate, reframe. So talks, podcasts, books, blog posts, these are kind of like the main media formats in which, like, if you see anything good, don't just like stick it in your memory and try to just, like, you know, try to hang on to it. You're going to forget most of it. Yeah. And you're going to miss out on a chance to tell people about it. And you're also going to miss out on a chance to engage with the person who connected to it. Like, it's pretty funny. Like, if you actually, you know, just randomly email the authors of your favorite books, they're likely to respond, because most people don't do it. So it's just a hack. It's honestly just like, people don't do this enough, so I can just continually recommend it. And, like, you know, less than 1% of people who actually even hear this advice will actually even follow up on it. So, like, I'm even comfortable, like, giving up my email address. I put it on my Twitter. I get maybe like 3 emails a week on just, like, you know, on these things. And yeah, people don't follow up. So if you're sold on this advice and you think that it works, or if you want to try and see whether it works, I think there are a bunch of people trying this out now and really kind of seeing for themselves, so I kind of don't have to prove it anymore. Anyway, I just think it's a good idea. So partially part of that summarizing thing is, again, falls back to that borrowing credibility thing. Like, one way to level up is to just have a nose for really good stuff and just summarize it and internalize it. I'm really keen on this idea of big L. You know how in algorithms we have big O?
Mm-hmm.
How something scales together with the amount of units or time or space or whatever. Big L is this idea that people can scale linearly, sublinearly, or superlinearly with their number of years of experience? And how do you change the curve of what you learn? I think it's doing stuff like this, like engaging at a higher level, engaging in a network, and be more reflective on what you learned. Because yeah, there's a blog post about Big L, and yes, he's a rapper that apparently a lot of people like. I don't know anything about that, but Big L notation for your career, for your learning. I think it's a very good structural thing to think about as you learn, because a lot of people don't really think about how they learn as they learn. So yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, I have to say it's when I look back, I mean, I feel like even this podcast is a way of like doing exactly what you said, like kind of like borrowing credibility and like picking up what others put down and just like understanding a little bit more than, you know, like what's on like the marketing sheet of a thing. And I think that, you know, there's so many avenues for people to just do that. And, you know, you don't have to come up with some original thought to start, you know, blogging and writing. You can just talk about like stuff that other people have talked about and just, you know, add a paragraph that makes it make sense to you or a drawing or whatever, and then link to the doc that you read to actually learn that thing. And I mean, that can be, you know, just so powerful. And like, you know, the audiences for those kinds of things can be, you know, depending on how you do it, can be like, you know, really big.
Yeah.
Like comics, right? Like, you know, we see this a lot. Like, you know, we're just like comics just explode for web developers.
Oh, yeah.
Love, you know, people love seeing like comics of, you know, code and, you know, mental models and whatnot.
Yeah. So Julia Evans, Lynn Clark,
yeah,
Samantha Ming, anyone with a modicum of like artistic ability, which rules me out. yeah. If you can sort of make tech, you know, we're so used to like just really dry and boring technical stuff. So if you can actually make it more accessible by drawing or illustration of some sort, then you really, really stand out. So yeah, I think that's a superpower. I'm actually keen on learning that just to try. Like I want to, like Sarah Vieira has been learning Blender. I think you talked about it in your podcast, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. So, and like, that's a way, like I can't draw, but I could probably like mess around with some 3D shapes and stuff like that. Like maybe that's more interesting, venue. But these are all just like ways to engage with your mentors. And I think
yeah,
that in a way that gives value back to them, eventually you're going to have to, you know, strike out on your own.
Sure.
But I think, What you get from engaging with these mentors is understanding what they think is important. And by definition, because they're all busy, they're all experts, they have things that they don't have time to do. So you can be their sort of right hand in doing those things. And you can eventually become their peer just by working on these things. And up to a point where you start disagreeing with them for the right reasons, that's when you sort of start to sort of level up past your mentors.
Yeah. Yeah. I love this. I love this idea that you're calling these people mentors, but you don't necessarily have to have a relationship, like a mentor mentee relationship with them. You know, mentors are, you know, a book, listening to a podcast, you know, reading someone's blogs, like, you know, these are your mentors. And, you know, being that first person and like kind of rising up as someone who appreciates that work and kind of expands the vision of it and the communication and talking points of it, the audience of it. Like no one's gonna hate you. No creator's gonna hate you for that.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you know, a lot of them probably rose up the same way. So
yeah. Yeah.
Like it's almost like this is the hidden rules of the game that nobody writes down. and then I just like went and wrote it down. And, you know, even then people don't, you know, part of this is like my fault, but, people insist on being on proceeding the way that they're taught.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it has to do with formal schooling. Like during formal schooling, we're given a path to succeed, and it's a very straight and narrow path. And I think in the real world, it's very different, especially in sort of the rather more egalitarian, like open source, you know, public sphere. It's a very different world from when we're in schools and on rails, essentially.
Yeah. On rails, I like that. Now we're just like blowing through time today. We're having,
I'm sorry,
having such a good time. No. I love talking with you. I mean, if we weren't trying to respect people's time, I was gonna say commute, but nobody has a commute anymore.
I know. You know, just... apparently podcasts have like taken a dive in terms of general listenership.
Huge dive. I can very much validate that. Yes, just nosedive. Yeah, the commutes are very critical to maintaining a podcast audience. But, you know, as we kind of like get to the end of this thing, I want to talk about something that you, an analogy that you've made, the operating system of you, talking, kind of taking something that we understand, you know, coding, operating systems, software, firmware, kernels, and mapping that over to the human, which it feels like maybe we should be, you know, already thinking about the human first. But I think as engineers, we kind of like to think that we're like just all brain and, you know, whatnot. So I love the way that you've mapped this back to, you know, the technical back to the human. Tell me about that concept, where it came from, and what the core philosophies of it are.
Yeah. Essentially, this is the chapter, this is the end where I realized that if I don't write this, everything else preceding it doesn't make sense. That's what also makes it a natural ending chapter. And it's this idea that, like, what if I just like handed you to you on a silver platter the best talks in the world, the best books in the world, the best courses, whatever, right? Like, the best advice in the world, like just like objectively, like from God.
Sure.
and just gave it to you and put it in front of you and said, like, this is the best, these are all the proof. Would you be able to put that and make use of that in your own life?
Hmm.
A lot of people would not, and it's mostly that's a result of not having a system to process and incorporate these sort of decisions and changes in their own lives. So I kind of think about it in that sense, like we as people. We kind of operate as an interface between the hardware, which is our bodies, and then our software, which is, I guess, you know, it's not even our software. It's like the applications of our software, right?
Sure. Yep.
Of our bodies towards a job, towards a career, towards being a human, which is kind of how I pair, tactics for job, strategies for career, principles for being a human. So I think that then the tricky part is to define the operating system on which all these applications run. And so I think that's, you know, when I sort of dig down to like the deepest habits that, you know, people like Scott Hanselman, who's been a developer for, you know, I think like 40 years, when they talk about having a long lived career, they don't talk about picking what they put down or like learning public, that kind of bullshit. They're like, take care of your back and your hands.
Yeah.
You're like, really core stuff. Like when Bill Gates talks about, I linked to his blog post. When Bill Gates talks about like how to, you know, like advice that like, you know, stands the test of time, he's like, sleep more. Like shit like that. You know what I mean? Like take care of your body. Because like we like to pretend that we, you know, we're all sort of virtualized people, but we're not. Like we have sort of bodies attached to us. I also like this analogy because I think that there's a lot of domains in which in computing we've learned to do things better than in terms of in dealing with humans. So what is an operating system? It's a way for us to manage limited physical resources and then run applications and sort of share resources on top of it. And I think that's a lot of what we're trying to do as humans as well. Like we have limited time, we have limited physical bodies and stuff like that. And then we're trying to run as much as possible, like get as much performance out of our hardware as possible, right? So we should actually, like, you know, we invest so much time at the application layer. We should maybe invest a little bit more time on the operating system layer as well. So I wanted to make a case for that. If I ever write a sequel to this book, it'd probably be that, like this chapter extended into a book form. I've already given a couple of talks about it, and I think it's an idea that's kind of spreading because the analogy is something that we all understand. Like, we have different levels of storage, right? Like, unfortunately, in our heads, the only forms of storage available to us is RAM, right? It's very lossy. You can even call it maybe like L1, L2, L3 cache. But like, basically, like there's different levels of storage, and we only have one available to us naturally. So we actually should extend it by working with external storage devices, like writing stuff down.
Yeah.
Like you can kind of like derive so much of the principles from these fundamental, like what are the limitations of our hardware and how do we sort of exceed those limitations? I can go further. Like what about, our environment that's around us? Like temperature control is something that matters as much for CPU as for humans, and oxygen control, like separating, I even go into things like, being able to virtualize other people. So when we code, we can actually code a lot better sometimes if we're able to virtualize what other people are like test our code against our model of how other people behave.
Sure.
So like the preemptive code review is another interesting idea that sort of falls out of this model. So there's all these ideas, and I think scheduling is another one that I'm pretty passionate about because I'm not very good at it. So this is very much of a learning. I put it as like the final chapter because I was like I'm least qualified to talk about this. But like, do you drop tasks? Do you have a problem prioritizing? Low urgency, high important things in your life. That's a lot of where we get screwed up because a lot of times we prioritize notification bells and like pings and like DMs and stuff like that, which really don't matter.
I'll do the important work after I, you know, get to inbox zero. And it's like, just unsubscribe from all that shit and move on with your life.
There's just a system to triage and manage and batch. I talked about all of that in these ideas, and something I got from Sarah Dressner as well is this batching idea. But then the last one that I leave all the way to the end, right? So what is at the core? Like you can strip out. These are all sort of like extraneous stuff that it's like, yeah, it's nice to have for operating systems. At the core of what an operating system is the kernel. It's the process that drives all the other processes. And if you lose that, which for humans, it's motivation. We call this drive. Like I use the word drive. If you lose your drive to code, you will stop coding. And we see that so often in tech. I pulled up a couple of examples on HackerDews where they're like, yeah, I reached a, like, you know, L whatever in Google. I'm being paid, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars and I'm totally unmotivated and I feel like quitting and burning out. So I think, you know, maintaining that drive and motivation to keep going and to have joy in your work, to understand that, you know, the code that you work on, may have a broader impact in something that you care about. I think those are really core important things to keep track on. So, the last chapter is kind of like a mixed bag of all these ideas. And it's an invitation to explore more because I definitely don't think I have the answers, but I think these are, you know, like, when we talk all the career stuff, it's cool, it's interesting, it might get you more money, but like ultimately you want to stay in the game and that's not burn out. And I think that's something that we should all spend a little bit of time talking about.
Yeah. You know, speaking of that last chapter, one of the quotes that you have in there that I'd not heard before, but is just so concise, is from James Clear. It says, "Your outcomes are the lagging measure of your habits. You get what you was it? You get what you repeat."
Yep.
And I think that is so. It really ties into everything that you're saying. Is that, and I think even what you said at the beginning. I don't even know if this was before or after we started, but talking about focusing on, what was it? Like systems over objectives,
goals.
Maybe?
Yeah.
Goals.
Systems
yeah.
over goals.
And this is so true. It's like the building of a process, like the building of you, the maintenance of your like operating system is what actually takes you the distance, not any kind of like external thing that, you know, I reached L whatever, LX, and I guess I'm like done now, right? Like there's always some place where you're done. And if you don't have a system that like actually carries you through and continues to motivate you, like you're cooked, you're done.
Totally. Yeah, you said it. You know, I think James is obviously, you know, the author of Atomic Habits, which is a lot of people's favorite book these days. I think that's a much healthier way to approach coding careers than the sort of go hard, go fast, like learn React in, you know, 60 seconds kind of thing. like we're in this for the long run. And I think that's something I'm also increasingly interested in. I don't know about passionate, but interested in, which is like, you know, sustainable ways to have a coding career rather than like, look how fast I'm rising. Look how senior I am. Like none of that matters. None of that matters.
Yeah,
are you happy? Ultimately, like,
how's your back feel?
People, I think this is like a uniquely American thing, but people are obsessed with learning how to learn. Right. And I talk a lot about that. Like, I'm like, learning in public is better than learning in private. Yeah, it's great. But there will always be things in which there will never be any end to things. You know, there's a limited number of things to learn, and you'll never be done. And maybe what's more important is learning how to be happy with what you already have. And nobody tells you that because anything that anyone markets to you is telling you that you're not good enough. It's telling you that you just like, you know, yeah, you, you, it's just giving you FOMO in some sort of way. So it's really hard for me to say that, because I'm also like trying to tell you like you're not good enough until you learn how to be good enough. But like, it's kind of true. And I freely give this away to anyone who listens, but sometimes you need to pay to take something more seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, hey, I think this episode's jam-packed of just really great advice. Tell people where they can go to get your book and this thing is huge. It's like, I think 400-ish pages?
450, yeah.
Oh my gosh. So we just barely scratched the surface of the topics and resources that you cover in your book. So where can people go to find more information about this book? And how to learn in public and do all the things that we've been talking about.
Sure. It's at learninpublic.org, which is the domain name. So it was originally called Cracking the Coding Career. Uh-huh. And then Gail McDowell, who wrote Cracking the Coding Interview, threatened legal action, so I had to rename it. So it's Coding Career Handbook. It's more generic. I don't love it, but anyway, I named it after the original .org. And the vision is to eventually develop this into a nonprofit. I've given away a quarter of the money that I've made to Free Code Camp. So so far I've given them about $10,000, but I will be giving them more. And then for listeners who made it all the way through the end, I always like to give a little something for people who follow through, because people often don't follow through. So I created a coupon. So it's learningpublic.org/ and then query C=ReactPod40, and they'll give you 40% off everything.
Awesome! And we'll link that in the show notes too. So if or I guess, should we not? Should we just leave that as for the people who followed through to the end?
It could be hard to type. So it's a query param. Sometimes people get it wrong. I just leave it in the show notes. It's fine. Like okay, I've done perfect. This for every podcast. And then the sales, like people just don't get to the end sometimes, So totally. If people want to, they can take me up on that.
Yeah. We'll link it regardless. I'm super excited to point people to your book, because it's just jam packed full of really great information and very concisely consolidated and curated information. So I just want to say thanks for putting it together, and I guess risking the being out there, because not everybody does. And I thank you for your service to the community for making this available.
You're very kind. But yeah, I very much acknowledge, like, this is the first book I ever wrote for money. I hope that this will be the worst version of the book. And what I can say is, I'll try to publish a new version every year and make it better. So I need your feedback. Let me know what you think. And you can reach me on Twitter at Swix. And the book has its own Twitter as well. So it's @coding_career.
Awesome. Well, go out, check it out. Thanks everybody for listening. Thanks, Swix, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This has been episode 114 of React Podcast with Chantastic and guest Sean Swix Wang. A transcript for this episode was sponsored by Kent C. Dodds. Thanks, Kent. At the moment, transcripts trail episodes by about 5 to 7 days, but it'll be up shortly. You can find that transcript along with the links and show notes at reactpodcast.com/114. If you like this show, there's a fast, free way to demonstrate your support. Leave us a review on iTunes. It's the best way for you to let me know what you think we're doing right and what we can improve. 2 to 3 minutes of your time helps us make the best show we possibly can. As always, links and show notes for all episodes are available at reactpodcast.com. This episode was edited by Mikhail Delport. It was produced by Mikhail Delport and Sarah Jackson at Spec, a network to help you level up in design and development. Check out spec.fm for other shows that are sure to fast track your career. I'm your friend Chantastic. Thanks for listening. We'll be in your ears again next week.